Support for Health Matters on MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Moorhead. Additional information on the Northeast AHEC is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome to Health Matters. I am your host and radio health evangelist, Dr. Tony Weaver. We call this the Reince Priebus Show because we are talking briefly about the former chief of staff of the White House, Reince Priebus, on our show. Just a few fun facts about him. I became intrigued by him. Thanks to our listeners at True Talk Internet Radio, and I have some company in the studio. I'd like to introduce, first of all, reading from left to right on your radio dial, from the University of Kentucky Physician Assistant Program, Assistant Professor Shelley Irving. Hi, Shelley.
Hello.
And from the University of Kentucky, the Interim Executive Director of Networking and Infrastructure, to explain to you how you can access Health Matters in between shows, Rick Phillips. Hi, Rick.
Hey, Tony, you know you can get the audio of the show at WMKY.org. That's right, Moorhead State Public Radio's website. They've got all the shows listed out there. You just have to find them in the menu. There's a summary there in case there's a specific show you're looking for. Otherwise, click on the link of a show, listen to it, download it, put it on your device, put it on a DVD, jump over to Facebook, do a search for HM Radio Show, or you can do facebook.com/HM Radio Show. Either way, you will find the fan page devoted to Health Matters. There, you can leave us some feedback, look at the posts. If you do Facebook, you kind of know what to do. Just like that page and kind of stand back and watch. It can be sometimes very funny, sometimes it can be very serious, and just depends on what's in the news or what's on our minds or what's on your mind for that matter. That's what it's all about. So leave Tony some feedback, leave show topics, ask a question. Depending on the question, you may or may not get it answered. More than likely you will. You may just may not like the answer. But that's what the fan page is for. So, Facebook.com/HM Radio Show.
Our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, Alzheimer's disease. Their motto, Alzheimer's disease. What is that motto again? We've got a couple of things here that I think are really interesting about Alzheimer's disease. This came from The Lancet, which is a British publication. Now, there has been a recent report by an American group on Alzheimer's disease, and they said there are very few things you can do really to alter the course of it or to protect yourself from it. We talk in the United States about aerobic exercise, and we talk about the possibility of something like fish oil. But in general, most people feel there's not a whole lot that you can do. Well, these people took a more aggressive approach. These things are not quite as strongly supported by scientific evidence, but they said, all right, here are some things that might lower your risk of Alzheimer's disease, and they have nine behaviors that could cut your dementia risk by one-third. This was presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in London. First of all, a couple of background facts, because I'm going to keep you in suspense about these nine behaviors until our next fractional portion. In 2015, about 47 million individuals worldwide were living with dementia. Care cost about $818 billion. Over 5.3 million Americans currently suffer from Alzheimer's disease and memory disorders. The Alzheimer's Association predicts the number will triple to 13.8 million by 2050. That is, as we get older, these various types of dementia are going to become more common. Worldwide, the number of people with dementia is expected to increase threefold by 2050. It doesn't have to be, but as it's currently projected, Alzheimer's disease may wind up being the 21st century's biggest killer. Now, we've got some other contenders here that we'll talk about later in the show, but that's what they're saying. So, this was the Lancet Commission on Dementia Prevention, Intervention, and Care. They reviewed existing literature. They did a new analysis to look into risk factors that had not been previously assessed. And they said, what can we do both in middle life and in later life to try to either slow it down or prevent it? See, Alzheimer's disease is such a problem of older people. If you actually slowed it down by 5 years, you could cut the rate of Alzheimer's disease in half. It happens as people get closer to dying, and if they died of something else and not Alzheimer's disease, you could actually cut the rates down substantially. So it is worth slowing it down. We'll give you those nine behaviors in our second fractional portion. That is our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, and this month's disease is Alzheimer's disease. Now, Reince Priebus. I've got some fun facts, and this is the level of research that we do. This is from Wikipedia. So it's not like I don't want our radio fans to think that we're spending huge amounts of WMKY dollars on our research, because we don't. We just look this stuff. We Google it. We go to Wikipedia.
So is one of the things on there his length of stay?
Yes.
Okay.
He was appointed January 20th, and he was out July 27th.
When?
January 20, July 27. 6 months.
Okay.
That is the shortest tenure of any non-interim White House chief of staff in American history. His full name, Reinhold Richard Priebus. They called him Reince. He attended the University of Wisconsin-Whitewater, majored in English and political science, graduated in 1994, and was the student body president. He went to the University of Miami Law School and was the student body president. He was elected chairman of the Wisconsin Republican Party in 2007, the youngest person ever to do that, and he managed to flip the state of Wisconsin, a traditionally Democratic state, to a Republican legislature and a Republican governor. He then ran for the National Republican Party. One of his skills in Wisconsin was to keep the Tea Party unified with the rest of the Republicans. So he was elected chairman of the Republican National Committee in 2011. And he was, as president, he saw the election of Donald Trump. He also cut the Republican Party back in 2011. He cut the Republican Party's overall debt in half in his first term. He also called on Republicans to embrace comprehensive immigration reform. Looked at their messaging to young people, women, and Hispanics. That is, this guy really was out to change and reform the Republican Party. Now, no one, I think, who is not Republican is going to agree with everything that Reince Priebus did. But on the other hand, this is a very, very effective leader. One thing he did get passed was Republican National Committee rules change that made the primary calendar shorter by up to 3 months. So we can have him to think that it wasn't longer than it actually was. He publicly criticized the Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump's response to temporarily suspend Muslim immigration in response to terrorist attacks. He also criticized him for Trump's comments regarding Captain Humayun Khan, a Muslim soldier killed in Iraq. He was, of course, accused by Anthony Scaramucci, no relation to me, of leaks for the White House, and he resigned on July 27th. So this is a guy I think that we may hear more from in the future. He has been a very effective political leader, but he was either due to his own problems or due to other problems was ineffective as a White House chief of staff and has now been replaced.
So, Tony, by my count, that's somewhere in the vicinity of 120 work days, right? So this guy worked, if he worked a five-day week over 6 months, and he worked a traditional 2,080-hour year, which I'm going to say these guys probably don't work the traditional 8 hours a day. But nonetheless, that's 120 work days, right? So if you took Health Matters and you put it on a radio station, a.k.a. something like, say, Morehead State Public Radio, and you just let it play for 24 hours a day, every episode we've ever made, you'd only get through. You'd have to play our show from its entirety three times through his tenure.
Do you know how long it took you to say that? Well, what I was thinking is,
well,
actually,
you always tell me to be filler.
Thank you for bringing up something that I'm sure no one else ever thought of. But I got to be honest. I was sitting there thinking, well, gee whiz, you know, it's going to take me longer to read this Wikipedia piece than it is for him to be chief of staff. I mean, meteoric is. I mean, that's kind. This guy.
Well,
was
meteors kind of go faster.
Yeah,
than that.
I know. That's why I use that term, because honestly, he was there a very, very short time. But he was there temporarily. He did experience the full Donald Trump, and he walked away and lived to tell about it. So I guess that part's good. Anyway, that's probably more than you'd ever want to know about Reince Priebus.
Well, Tony, we've had people on the show that probably didn't last that long, right?
I don't know.
I'm trying to think. I'm trying to go back in our mirror ranks. I mean, it's hard. No, I guess what I'm trying to point out is something that you're rarely going to talk about on the air because you don't like to do this. But we are rapidly approaching. I think we're within two or three shows of our 800th show.
Okay. That is true. We number our shows, and I think we're around 799.
I think you lost count.
I'm sure I messed up numbering. I mean, gee whiz, it's been 13 years.
It's actually been 14. Closer to 15.
Yeah.
But that's nobody's
counting. But nobody's counting, and that's right. The problem, isn't it?
So, you know, all I'm saying is we got a lot of shows.
We got a lot of shows.
And he doesn't have a lot of experience.
No, I think we've... we've easily exceeded Ryan's previous, but the thing is, he's where he has been. What he has had, other than in the Trump White House, he has had a remarkable degree of success, and a guy to keep a lookout for, because I think we will be hearing more from him in the future.
He probably got a book deal.
Here's a heartwarming story for you. This was July 31st. I got this out of the Washington Post, but it was LAX 18 reported it first, I believe. That was the source of the Washington Post. There's a Kentucky obstetrician named Amanda Hess. She was in Frankfort. She was pregnant and, in fact, ready to deliver her baby. She checked into the Frankfort Regional Medical Center as a patient, put on her hospital gown, was ready to have her labor induced. When down the hall, a woman in another room was wailing away, according to NBC News. That was Leah Johnson. I think that's the way, L-E-A-H. Is that Lee or Leah? I guess it's Leah. I think so. Anyway, she was about to deliver, and here's the key sentence for me. The on-call doctor had left the hospital for a break, and they needed immediate help. So Amanda Hess put on a second hospital gown to cover her backside, went in there, and delivered another patient's baby while she was getting ready to deliver her own baby. It's a wonderful story. What a great doctor. All the good things, and to take absolutely nothing away from Amanda Hess. But you know, Rick, where I am, and I think most doctors are, when they read this story, we're going, oh, my gosh, what in the world happened to that on-call obstetrician? I mean, would it not, if you're goofing off, and I'm not saying this guy's goofing off. I don't know what this guy was doing. But if you happen to not be where you should be for your job, and it makes the national news, somebody comes in during your break, and they're in the national news for doing your job. This would be very difficult. This is the dark side of heartwarming stories.
So why'd you bring it on the show?
Because he's a downer. This is what he
is. I mean, come on. You're dragging these poor people down with your sinking ship.
I feel sorry for this guy. And I don't know what happened, but...
He was taking a break. Why do you feel sorry for him?
Well, but you're an obstetrician. You can't take a break when a woman's in labor. This is, you know, I mean, this is... She did more... But you got to say this guy, and I don't know this guy, and he's not been named, and I hope he's not named. That was, I think the hospital may have had at least a patient care conference about this thing. Why is it that people are making the national news delivering babies in our hospital when we're supposed to be doing that ourselves?
Well, I mean.
We at Health Matters are about to take a well-deserved break. So if you need radio services during our break, then you should just take care
of
it yourself.
I'm sure somebody will step in and help you out.
Ask your neighbor to put on an extra gown and come over and read something to you while we're gone. Meanwhile, we're going to come back with our second fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.
Hello and welcome back. This is the second fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Ryan Spreba Show. We are celebrating the brief but meteoric career of Ryan Spreba as the White House Chief of Staff. We are warning our radio fans that they may hear more from Ryan Spreba. He seems to be a man who has a future.
But don't worry, it'll be quick.
don't blink.
That's absolutely right. Our sponsor for the second time, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's disease, Alzheimer's disease, and their motto, Alzheimer's disease, what is that motto again? There are 9 behaviors that could cut your dementia risk by one-third, according to this British expert panel. They did a literature review. Now, these are not as solidly supported by science as the ones that the Americans have mentioned, the regular aerobic exercise, but to be honest, there are some of these lifestyle changes that I think are worth trying. So I'm going to start with the lowest of the 9. Number 9, midlife obesity, that makes up about 1%. If you can control your weight in midlife, you are 1% less likely to become to develop Alzheimer's disease in older life.
So is that worth controlling your diet?
That's a 1%? Good question. Maybe.
I mean, chocolate pie is awful good.
I know, and you could have a lot of fun in midlife. But then midlife obesity leads to later life diabetes, which is another 1%. So it starts to add up. Ding,
so
ding.
So 2%.
Yeah, you're up
That's
to 2%.
That's the milk I drink.
You know, it's going to be so hard to tell when you have Alzheimer's disease. That's the thing. Because if you
are you going to let me still do the show?
Why not? What would change? That's the question. I'm sorry. Midlife hypertension, 2%. Now we're up to 2%. That's the milk number, isn't it, Rick? Right? The milk
I don't know. I really don't like milk, but it's, I was thinking, what is 2%?
Now, later life social isolation makes up 2%.
That's you.
Thanks. I appreciate that. You know, I was going to say something really erudite about later life social isolation. I believe that social isolation is really a – it has so much contribution to other conditions. There is an article in New Science magazine I was just reading yesterday that indicated that it can increase your risk of dying all causes by around 26%. It's about as bad as being morbidly obese in terms of your health.
Well, and we've talked about this years and years and years. I mean – this is why when you get older, you either got to go to the VFW, you got to go to church, you got to stay socially engaged, right? You just have to. It's probably one of the most important things you can do as an elderly person.
And it does not seem that social media gives you that same satisfaction. This article was emphatic about that. So we've got obesity at 1%, diabetes at 1%, midlife hypertension, high blood pressure at 2%, later life social isolation 2%. Now, physical inactivity, 3%. Now, there's something. One, you could enjoy the physical activity, and two, you're now past the milk number, as Rick would call it, in terms of the percentage of cases of dementia caused by this factor. So staying physically active, and if you can stay physically active with other people, that's even better.
So, Tony, is that an actual statistic, or is that just a correlation?
That's the American people. We'll talk about aerobic exercise. So I think in this case, on both sides of the Atlantic, they are in agreement that this is the best thing you can do. We talked about this over and over again. It is the single best investment you can make.
But as soon as you start talking about fitness, I quit listening.
No, I know you better. I mean, you're putting on an on-air persona. This is your
just for you,
de plume.
Just for you,
this
Tony.
This is your whatever they are. But the point is, I know that you do exercise regularly.
Yeah, I know. I played racquetball last night.
Yeah, and so I feel like that's an important driver of health. And both American and British authorities agree that that's a pretty important factor, which you can modify. You can decide you want to be more physically active, choosing your activity. So that's up to 3%. 4%, late-life depression. Now, this is a tough one.
Yeah,
I don't think
it's hard to joke about this one.
Yeah, another thing is it's hard to modify. I can tell you, don't get depressed. That is not easy to do. But they consider these to be modifiable, these 9 lifestyle factors. So in some way or another, lowering your risk of depression.
How are they modifying that across the pond?
Good question. There is nothing in this article. Oh, provide support for family caregivers, including interventions for depression. That's it. So we need support to try to identify depression early.
You said caregiver, though.
Yeah.
So is this assuming the person who's depressed is a caregiver?
Okay. Now you're making me actually read this, and this is really annoying me, Shelly. Don't let me eject you from the room.
Okay. Well, you know, if caregiving, long-term caregiving, is a risk for depression, and then that increases your risk for dementia.
You got to shuck the old people as rapidly as possible to
what
just
did
to protect
you just
your own
say?
Health. That's a corn. It's a corn processing term. You got to get them out.
I was just going to go with increased resources to take care of people who need long-term care.
Yeah. Well, that's okay, too,
that's
I guess.
That's one way you could do it.
Yeah. But you're right. I look for depression. I found that very quickly. Shelley then pinned me down on that. What can you do about depression? How can you protect yourself against depression? Well, one, social isolation. But that's, you know, people get depressed over the loss of physical health. They get depressed. There's the endogenous depression that people get that has to be treated with medication. That is a very tough one.
What happens to people when they do 800 radio shows?
Well, their audience gets depressed. I mean, we are sowing depression all over the eastern part of the state.
This is terrible, Tony. I can't. This is bad.
Later life smoking, 5%. All right, so even worse than Health Matters is late life smoking.
That's 5%. Why we don't like cigarettes.
And yes, I mean, there's so many reasons, but this is one of them. It increases your risk of dementia. Early life education is 8%. Now, granted, you can't go back, but you can try to add education later on in life to try to protect yourself. It appears that you can certainly encourage your children to get as much education as possible because that seems to be somewhat protective. The idea is it maybe increases your reserve. Whether or not getting a degree, they specifically mentioned that there's no evidence that being bilingual helps, except that if that required extra education, that's a good thing. And then the top one, the number one, which will catch you completely off guard, coming out of left field, midlife hearing loss, 9% of dementia risk. And midlife hearing loss at 9% contributes more than the APOE4 gene, that's the gene that disposes you to Alzheimer's disease, which is 7% of risk of all dementias. So they feel that protecting your hearing in midlife is the single most important thing you can do to prevent becoming demented later on.
So are they doing hearing screenings over there, midlife screenings?
They didn't say that. But it would seem that a hearing screening would be important, wouldn't it? The idea is very clear. If you cannot participate in conversations, if you deprive yourself of a sense, and I haven't seen any data saying that a person who, say, is blind is more likely to develop dementia. But they are saying that people who have hearing loss are more likely. And the idea is if you cannot carry on a conversation, if you cannot hear new ideas, if you cannot communicate well, then, in fact, you're at more risk for dementia.
So many of these are interrelated. It's difficult for me to tease these out.
Well, and I want to stress again, everyone admits that these are supported by softer science than the traditional things, the aerobic exercise, which is really the heart of what we do here in this part of the world. But again, social isolation, smoking, no one is arguing about those things. Early life education seems to be protective, but again, you can't go backwards and make that up. No one's going to question, I think, that obesity, diabetes, and high blood pressure should be managed for your overall health. But the hearing loss surprised me, and I wanted to make our radio fans aware of that. It's do with it what you will. That is our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club. This month's Alzheimer's disease is our disease, and this is a national British panel, and they are looking at the risk factors for dementia, some of which may be modifiable. Now, we talked last time in jest about what happens when someone comes in while you're on your break and makes national news by doing your job. I submit that that is not a good position to be in. I submit that there may have been some administrative meetings at the Frankfurt Hospital about why it was that the TV crews were covering someone else delivering a baby in their hospital. But this should not distract from a problem that we have. This was in the AMA Journal, and it was on July 25th. The title of this is Why is U.S. Maternal Mortality Rising? It's not because these obstetricians are taking a break, but the numbers are disturbing. In the United Kingdom, where they talk about hearing loss and Alzheimer's disease, the number of mothers who die from complications related to childbirth is 9 for every 100,000 births. In Canada, 7 for every 100,000 births. In the United States, 25 for every 100,000 births, up from 23 last year. It is higher than these other countries by a factor of 3 or 4 almost now in the case of Canada, and it is still rising. A lot of poorer countries, Iran, Romania, saw declines in their maternal mortality, but it got worse here in the United States.
So what is the cause of death?
The actual cause of death, I believe there are postpartum hemorrhage would be probably one of the leading causes, and it would be a cardiac or a pulmonary death, I would assume. I don't think it's due to infections, and there are, as you know very well, Shelley, there are a number of other conditions associated with pregnancy and delivery, but none of them seem to be life-threatening, I don't believe.
Is this more of a statement of the overall health of American women?
It's a good question. This is what they say. There's not any good data to tell us why our maternal mortality is increasing. And by the way, between the years 2000 and 2014, it's up more than 25%. So there's a very – this is not just a blip. This is not just a temporary little artifact. This is a steady increase in our maternal mortality. The number of deaths is much higher among African-American women than other races. So perhaps it is about access to care. Perhaps it is about underlying health. Obesity is one of the possible causes. It is pregnancy and delivery is much more risky in a person who is obese. They mentioned a couple of things that I think are tricky to figure out. California has shown some declines. Texas has seen some of the largest increases in the country. There, between 2011 and 2014, their maternal mortality rate doubled. And keep in mind that Texas has worked very hard to limit family planning resources through their legislative action. So one of the possibilities is if you limit family planning resources, and let's be very blunt about that. That is not only the provision of birth control and family planning services, it is these abortion clinics as well. But it appears that for whatever reason, Texas is having a lot more problems than California, and Texas has chosen to limit that more than most states. Perhaps, again, obesity is another possibility. Maybe it's because we do more cesarean sections and they have a complication of the surgery. That seems a bit of a stretch to me.
Fertility drugs?
They didn't mention them as a possibility. When you look at the population at large, those things are so expensive, fertility clinics so expensive, probably not enough to really affect population. And then finally, maybe it's better record keeping. The Aaron Carroll, who wrote this article in the AMA Journal, doesn't believe that. He says, you know, most countries are keeping adequate records. I don't think that we're just picking up maternal mortality that they're not. So we do have a problem, and that problem is more than people taking breaks. It's probably access to health care. We're going to come back to that again and again in this show because this is one of the problems. You see this. The point I want to make for Health Matters listeners is things are not getting better. If we're just waiting out all these things and on our way to a much happier future, that's not going to work. We're going to have to take action to improve our healthcare system because things are, in fact, getting worse.
There he goes, being a downer again.
I know. You can't get him to go the other direction, right? And it's not like he hasn't been doing this for, at least I say, 800 shows.
We need to find him some new material.
Well, the problem is we let him find the material.
All right, well, I'm sure this will please both of you. Old people are dying on the job at higher rates than other workers, so
how's that happier news?
Well, I figure if I die over here, then maybe you can take over the show and turn it in the direction you guys want to do it. I don't know. It seems it's really hard to please people here. Radio fans, please write into Facebook and tell Rick and Shelley to just can it. That's would be my recommendation. Just can it.
You can't even say something like that and make it sound good.
August 2nd, the Associated Press, 2015, 35% of fatal workplace accidents involved a worker 55 and older. 1,600 of the 4,800 fatalities reported nationally. Number of deaths among all workers has dropped since 2005 by about 1,000, but on-the-job fatalities among older workers has actually been increasing.
Is it really increasing, or is the number of workers in that age group increasing?
Good question. The way they describe increasing is 1,500 to 1,600 in the past 10 years. So are there more – there certainly are more workers that are holding on to their jobs longer. And you don't think about the possibility of dying on the job. That's not something that people think about. During that time period, number of older people in the workplace increased by 37%, 6% rise in the population of workers overall. Types of accidents, fall-related fatalities up 20%, contact with objects and equipment 17%, transportation accidents 15%. Fires and explosions decreased by 8%. So, I mean, we're not exploding as much.
There you go.
Some good news right there. The explosions have decreased by 8%.
We'll take what we can get.
This is awful. Nevada, New Jersey, Washington had the greatest increase in fatal accident rates for older workers between 2006 and 2015. The three states with the biggest percent decrease were Hawaii, Oregon, and Vermont.
Well, wonder if any of this has to do with hearing or vision decreases.
Now, that's exactly where they're pinning this. That is, the workplace is designed for younger workers. If the lighting is not good, if a person with a diminished hearing, cannot hear warning signs, warning bells, not able to see those flashers, then that can be a problem. A lot of this is also balance problems as people get older and trying to do the same job that you did as a younger person. They gave a couple of examples of people who've been doing the same job for 10 or 20 years and had a safety lapse and wound up dying on the job unnecessarily, a very preventable accident that they did not, in fact, follow their guidelines that they have been using for the past decade. They simply made a mistake, and it really came back on them. So I think I did some talks for the Society of Engineers in Lexington a few years ago, and one of the things we talked about was redesigning the workplace for older people. You've got to have better lighting. You've got to have wider pathways. The alarms have to be both visual and audible, and there are some things that you can do to make your workplace safer for older people. Obviously, you can get rid of the older people. That would be the other thing, since we're in the process of shucking them. But if older people are going to be in the workplace, then you have to do some redesign of the workplace. They simply don't have the mobility, the vision, the hearing that the younger people do. And it is coming back. Their risk of dying on the job is substantially higher. And especially these are things like warehouse things, operating equipment, machinery, things like that. It does get more dangerous as a person gets older past a certain point.
Well, they've got more comorbidities and probably higher risk for complications from any injury that they would have.
That's a good point. Not able to protect themselves as well in a fall or some type of traumatic accident. And although the explosion rate is going down, still explosions, an older person doesn't take an explosion like a younger person. I think, Rick, I mean, when we were younger, we could take an explosion. I could take an explosion. You know what I mean?
Did you say make?
No.
Or did you say take?
Well, that was that, too. But, I mean, how many explosions?
Tony, were you fascinated by fire as a kid?
No, I never had that.
No M80s? No.
No, wait a second. When you talk about fire, explosions and fire are different things.
And fireworks are,
yeah, I understand. But, no, I was not fascinated by fire. But we did have access to some of those really high-grade M80s, which were basically
miniature sticks of dynamite, didn't you?
Yeah. And you could get stuff. You could blow stuff up. You could wreck a structure pretty well with an M80.
Nice. I'm just saying. It's. Yeah.
And you would not believe how far you can shoot a basketball if you put an M80 on a pipe and put an M80 down a pipe and put the basketball on top of it.
Shelley, this is how you take one word and change one word in his sentence, and you can totally derail him.
Yeah. I'm learning.
I'm just saying I can take an explosion with the best of them. I could, but now as I've got older, that's not so. And so I have to have special workplace considerations. It takes longer to start the show up. We speak more slowly. Sean Delaney, our producer, he is now busy editing all the uhs and ums out of the show because I can't speak as well as I used to. And it takes longer to get to our breaks. But we're going to take a break right now. We're going to take a break and come back with our third and final fractional portion. You're listening to Health Matters on Morehead State Public Radio.
Hello and welcome back. This is the third and final fractional portion of Health Matters. I'm Rick Phillips.
I'm Shelley Irving.
I'm Dr. Tony Weaver. This is the Reince Priebus Show. Our salute to former White House Chief of Staff Reince Priebus and his brief stay as he flashed across our national TV screens before disappearing and resigning from the White House. The shortest duration Chief of Staff in U.S. history.
But isn't it not about how long he did it, but how well he did it? I mean, isn't that what it's all about?
Well, under his tenure,
I'm not even sure how
under his
grade
brief
him.
Tenure, and how can you even do an assessment when it was only 6 months long? The rumors were that the White House was chaotic, but if you think about the number of times you've heard the word chaos used to describe anything related to Donald Trump, you realize that is the press's word. If you want one word for Donald Trump, it is chaos.
So, Tony, one of these days, in our next 800 shows,
right,
we're going to have to talk about the chaos theory. Right? There's many theories around chaos, and within IT, there are some pretty crazy ones. One of them is actually called a chaos monkey. And if you can release a chaos monkey in your environment, there's actually research that suggests you can make your environment better. If your people are able to deal with that kind of chaos, it actually makes you a top performer. And so chaos is not necessarily a bad thing.
All right. Aside from the fact that now I have a new name to call you, this
we can talk about it someday.
I know this intrigues me,
but what there are management strategies.
Let me make sure if I understand, because I've heard this before. The idea is that if you create that chaos, you'll find out who your leaders are, and the team will band together to fix it.
Correct. They don't really have. Yeah, and the thing about the chaos monkey is you can't tell them you're doing it.
Right.
If they know you're doing it, then they get mad at you.
Right. And but so I used that very same theory to try to apply for a job. I said, you know, look, I can bring unity to this office because everybody's going to have to fix a bunch of things if you hire me.
Right.
And so I am that person who brings everyone else together.
So it's between you and the hiring agent as to what your goal is.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'm going to make your organization better and stronger because I don't know what I'm doing.
Right. And you
and
could
I'm
say,
sitting between two monkeys, apparently.
Chaos monkeys. Sure. But your comment then is that in that case, all right, taking that then to politics, and you have heard this theory as well as I have, and I don't know why we're doing this on a health show, but you brought up chaos monkeys, so fine, we'll talk about chaos monkeys.
No, I said we could talk about it in our next 800 shows.
I know, gradually, but let me throw this idea out then. There is the idea that Donald Trump is a unifier because everyone is unified in trying to minimize the damage that Donald Trump does.
You would have to believe that based on the media, based on what you see on TV, based on what you hear, people are pretty unified against him.
If he can bring about a bipartisan solution to our health care problems in opposition to his leadership, then maybe good comes out of this. Maybe he is the chaos monkey.
I don't know. I'm just saying it is a theory that is talked about in circles on a way to take a look at things and how to – it's essentially evaluate your organization or give your organization the opportunity to grow and be better. So if he's doing it on purpose, hats off to him. If he's not doing it on purpose, then that's when you may have – he may be getting some side benefit out of the deal. You never know.
Our sponsor, the Disease of the Month Club, this month's disease, Alzheimer's disease, reminding you of their motto, Alzheimer's disease, what is that motto again? We have 9 key findings on preventing Alzheimer's disease from the Lancet. This was presented at the Alzheimer's Association International Conference in London. And this is basically a British group that did a literature review, and they found some risk factors, modifiable, some of them. We're not certain about the others. Modifiable risk factors that might lower your risk of dementia by 1/3 if you were able to address all these things. First, midlife obesity, 1% of the risk of dementia. Second, Rick, by the way, while I'm doing these and I am informing you about how to protect your brain, Rick is showing me pictures of monkeys that he has looked up on his computer. This is the type of chaos that I have to deal with.
Tony, I'm trying to make you better.
Oh, where is Reince Priebus when you need him? I need someone to limit access to me right now. Midlife obesity, 1%. Late life diabetes, 1%. Midlife hypertension, 2%, which is, incidentally, the percentage of fat in Rick's milk. Which I didn't need to know.
Wow, this show's gone down.
Later life social isolation, 2%. Later life physical inactivity, 3%. Late life depression, 4%. Smoking in late life, 5%. Early life education, 8%. And midlife hearing loss, 9% of dementia risk. So again, if you protect your hearing, get as much education as you can. Studiously avoid smoking. Remain physically active. Cultivate friendships and social engagement. Take care of your high blood pressure, diabetes, watch your weight, and in some way try to avoid depression. You may be able to cut your risk of dementia by 1/3. And again, that is about 4 times the risk of one particular gene, the APOE4 gene, which is the most common gene associated with Alzheimer's disease. Now, I don't know how well this will work. I don't know that the science behind that is strong, but it at least gives us a roadmap to do something other than just despair over our risk of Alzheimer's disease. That makes sense to me.
And none of those things are harmful.
That's true. This is healthy living at its best. Next up, August 1st, Annals of Internal Medicine. This was data published from the 2015 National Survey on Drug Use and Health. Rick, you'll like this. They abbreviate the National Survey on Drug Use and Health. That is the NSDUH. I, who love acronyms, notice things like that. 72,000 eligible civilian non-institutionalized adults selected. 51,000 completed the survey interview. That is a one-hour in-your-house interview, and you get compensated $30 for it. This is quite a bit of work to do. So if you extrapolate the data from the 51,000 people in 50 states, this is what you get. In 2015, an estimated one-third, well, actually over one-third, 37.8% of adults used prescription opioids. 37.8%. Wow. Over one-third of U.S. adults were given a prescription for a narcotic, that's what we used to call them, an opioid pain reliever. 4.7% misused them. That means they took them not the way the doctor said or without a doctor's prescription. And 1.9 million, that's 0.8%, had a use disorder. The most commonly reported motivation for misusing opioids was pain relief. 63.5% said, I'm taking this drug because I am in pain. Relaxing, 11%, getting high, about 11%. Of the adults who misused the drugs, 60% got them without a prescription, and 41% got them free from friends or relatives.
Wow.
So the idea of a person going to a pusher man, you remember the pusher?
Mm-hmm.
That was what we used to call them, a drug pusher. Now they're drug dealers. They don't push anymore, but they used to push. And you go to a drug pusher to get high, that's not the way the majority of these opioid drugs we're talking about in this interview were, in fact, getting into the hands of the consumers. In fact, the leading, again, this was the single, it was 40% of the overall total who misused it. They were getting it for free from friends and relatives. 13% of adults with use disorders obtained their most recently used prescription from drug dealers or drug pushers. So most of these drugs are coming from relatives. One, it means that these people have too many drugs in their household.
Mm-hmm. Right.
If you're giving away drugs for free, then we probably ought to restrict access to drugs. And we have worked very hard. Kentucky has led the nation in legislation to try to reduce the amount of narcotics that are floating around in people's medicine cabinets and in their purses and personal items. We're trying to get that as low as we possibly can. But the other part of it is if, in fact, two-thirds of the people who are using these drugs to relieve, are using them without a doctor's prescription, are still using them for pain relief, then we still have a problem with pain relief.
Right.
You can't just simply legislate away a drug class. As bad as narcotics are, and I hate these drugs have killed Kentuckians, 1,000 a year, marched to the cemetery because of narcotic overdose. Some of them for fun, a lot of them because of drug interactions they didn't anticipate. And they wind up taking these drugs for pain and then dying because of it. Patients who prescribe the drugs don't fully use them, obviously, because they've got them around. The other thing that was of interest to me, men, college graduates, and people ages 18 to 49 were less likely to have been prescribed opioids than women and older and not college graduates. The people who are using them have lower family income, are uninsured or unemployed, the ones who misuse. So what happens pretty obviously is if you have pain and you are a man with a job and insurance, you go to your doctor, you get a prescription for pain, and it might be an opioid drug. But if you don't have insurance, you don't have a job, you are a woman, you are of lower socioeconomic status, you bum them off friends, you get them where you can. And so suddenly a portion, maybe a big portion, of our substance abuse problem becomes we're not taking care of, we're not providing access to low-income people to get their pain treated medically. They simply have to bum stuff off their friends or get it on the street.
Well, they probably don't have the resources or the ability to take the necessary time off work after they have an injury. You know, they continue to work, they continue to hurt themselves.
Yeah, and so this is... Once again, this gets more complicated. I mean, it's easy to say there's the pusher man. The pusher man's pushing the narcotics. I'm sorry, I'm using 60s terminology here, but I'm having a lot of fun for this, you know. The pusher man pushes the narcotics on our kids who are taking the narcotics just to get high or low, because after all, narcotics, I suppose high is the right word. I think of low.
I've lost track of the terms.
We're not really up to speed on all this high tech stuff, Tony. It's not. This is a vocabulary that I'm not familiar with.
A bunch of working class old people talking about the pusher man and narcotics. But stay with me here on this, because in all seriousness, that's the common misconception and the myth. And certainly, not to discount that, there are people who do that, but there are a sizable number of people who simply have no options for taking care of their pain. They cannot take off work. Oh, yes, why don't you have acupuncture? Where are you going to get acupuncture in rural Kentucky? Where are you going to get massage in rural Kentucky? We do have, thanks to, and I'll my hat's off to them, the College of Osteopathic Medicine coming out of Pikeville, we have osteopathic physicians who can do osteopathic manipulative therapy, which may relieve back pain and lessen the need for prescription medications. But once again, you have to have insurance. You have to have the ability to get a person who practices that type of medicine. And if you don't have that, then you're back bumming narcotics off your relatives again. Mm-hmm. So if we have an organized approach to pain, it's going to help us a lot with prescription opioid use and abuse. And it may cut down the number of people who then become addicted and then have to turn to, as I call it, the pusher man, into narcotics dealers. I've got one more thing, Rick.
Okay.
And so we're going to talk for a little bit.
Uh-oh.
Okay. Are you all right with that?
Sure.
Okay. I just wanted to be sure. Are you going to show me any pictures while we do this? Because no. I don't need the distraction.
No.
Okay.
It was merely an article on how Netflix injects a chaos monkey into their system to help their system get better. That's all. That's all that picture was.
And you thought that was important enough. While I was busy doing our 799th or so radio show, you thought you had to put that on the air. That this was important. Oh, we need to see a picture of a monkey.
I have to validate myself at times with you. Yes, I do.
I'm just glad this is radio, because it was a pretty ugly monkey.
It was. I have to admit, it was right out of one of the scary movies.
It was a shocking monkey.
It was pretty ugly.
And it was designed to throw me off.
Work.
And Sean is busy. Sean deletes all my us. And Sean was busy. He was just like he was playing a video game there, deleting all the us while Rick was showing me monkey pictures.
And so the show's going to end sooner today.
So stay tuned for more music from WMKY, because we ran out of radio time. All right, so here's what I got. Health and Spirituality. This is July 27th. This was the AMA Journal. And this came out of the Harvard's School of Public Health, their Cancer Institute, and their medical school in Cambridge and Boston, Massachusetts. It was published online July 27th. They're talking about spirituality in medicine. A 2016 Gallup poll, 1,025 adults in the United States, 89% believe in God or a universal spirit. 75% consider religion of considerable importance. Now, we at Health Matters, obviously, we take on the pusher man, and we talk about Texas family planning, and so we are not afraid to take on anything. But we feel that if 89% of people believe in God, 79% consider that of considerable importance, we need, as a society, to have somewhere to put that. You can't simply wall that off and stereotype it as people who are intolerant of other people. 75% consider religion of considerable importance. This is from the Nurses' Health Study, followed more than 74,000 participants, 16 years. Women who attend a weekly religious service had a 26% lower mortality rate compared with those who never attended. Now, you can say, well, if you're able to go to church, then obviously you can walk, you should be in better health. They control for that. They tried to match them up, the walkers and the non-walkers, and they still found that there was a significantly lower mortality rate for those who went to religious services. It did not span over to people who watched religious services on TV. They specifically looked at that. If you listen to the radio, if you watch a church service on TV, not the same thing. Now, this may be that social isolation we were just talking about with Alzheimer's disease. That may be what we're looking at. Church is a great way to avoid social isolation. If you attend religious services more than once a week, you have a 33% lower mortality rate and a 29% reduction in your depression risk. So right there, if you're looking at our Alzheimer prevention map, if we can drop your depression risk by 29% and we can give you social support by being in church, church is a pretty good place to be, whatever church is to you.
Especially in rural areas.
They have potlucks, too.
Yeah.
Now, then you're talking about your obesity and diabetes. There's the problem.
Well, you just have to control yourself, but they do have good potlucks. Yeah. Although we have reported at times where there have been some bad potlucks.
Oh, you remember that bad potluck. That was, let's see, what was it? It was, she made tuna salad, wasn't
That's
it?
Right, that's
and,
right.
Yeah, and left the tuna salad
darn near
out.
Killed the congregation.
Darn near destroyed the...
But don't let that sway you. Go to church.
Avoid the tuna salad. We're just saying, you know, if your communion includes tuna salad, then just no. That's a bad idea. Sixfold reduction suicide risk for those who attended religious services. Now, maybe they mention one of the things, it enhances social integration. There's no doubt about that. And if you're around other people who don't smoke and those other people challenge you to walk more, to do healthy things, to eat healthier foods, then that can be a very valuable thing. Now, you don't get spirituality for the health benefits. You don't say, I'm going to believe in God because that'll help me live longer. That really does not work. On the other hand, many people do, and many people achieve benefits from that. And I don't think, as we talk about going to a national health care system, I don't think we pay enough attention right now to the role that spirituality would play in people's health. And neither does, in fact, the folks at Harvard who wrote this editorial in the AMA Journal. Recent analysis of 10 prospective studies, more than 136,000 participants showed that having a higher purpose in life was associated with a 27% reduction in all-cause mortality as well. So our final closing thoughts here are it would be important in taking care of people to acknowledge their spirituality, and we as a society are having problems with that. Meanwhile, we do have a higher purpose. Rick, can you get us off the air?
Special thanks to our Morehead State Public Radio producer, Sean Delaney, and to Eric Bilbrey, who wrote our Health Matters theme song, and to you, our loyal radio fans. Remember to show your support for Health Matters by visiting our digital empire. To listen to the show, go to WMKY.org or visit us on Facebook. Just do a search for HM Radio Show.
For our radio crew and the supportive folks at the Northeast AHEC, thanks for listening to our show. And remember these side effects shared by Health Matters and opioid drugs.
Health Matters kills over 100 people every day.
Health Matters overdoses kill more Americans under age 50 than anything else.
If synthetic Health Matters spreads rapidly, the total number dying could rise to 250 deaths per day. That's the same number of Americans dying from breast cancer and prostate cancer combined.
Health Matters could kill nearly as many Americans in a decade as HIV/AIDS has killed since that epidemic began.
Experts agree Health Matters overdoses will not even begin to level off until sometime after 2020, and only if the federal government's efforts to boost radio enforcement and push listeners to turn their radios off are effective.
Whatever you do, do not become a statistic. Do not take this stuff lying down. Get out this week, make a healthy change in your life, and tune in next week for more exciting news from the world of medical research on Morehead State Public Radio.
Support for MSPR comes from the Northeast Kentucky Area Health Education Center, located at the St. Clair Regional Medical Center in Morehead. The Northeast AHEC connects students to careers, professionals to communities, and communities to better health. The Northeast AHEC strives to improve the supply and distribution of healthcare professionals through the community and academic educational partnerships. More information is available online at neahec.org.